Call the meeting to order.
Microphone just broke.
We do have a quorum. We need someone to approve the minutes dated Tuesday, February 21st. Representative McElfatrick moves the minutes. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Members, today we do have House File 2158, Representative Keel's bill. Representative Keel, if you'd like to move to the podium or move up front there. And we do have a number of testifiers as well. So, Representative Keel, if you'd like to move your bill.
Yes, I would like to move bill number 2158.
And Representative Keel moves House File 2158 be recommended pass and move to the, where are we going, General Register?
Yes.
Move to the floor? Okay.
General right. Register, yes. Thank you.
Pardon me? All right, Representative Keel, you do have an amendment. Do you want to explain your bill, or would you like to move the amendment first and then explain the bill?
I think we should move the amendment.
All right. Representative Keel moves the amendment, H2158, the DE1 amendment. So everybody have a copy of the DE1 amendment? So Representative Keel, you want to speak to the amendment first?
This is the DE1 amendment, a bit of a technical amendment that moves the exemptions for railroads, taconite mining, logging, and logging equipment to an exemption until May 1st of 2020. This was supposed to expire on May 1st of 2012. So.
Okay, and then also there is a yes. change, Representative Keel, on line 1.21 as well?
Yes, yes.
And that is for number
that,
one diesel.
That keeps the diesel fuel at 2015, the exemptions there.
For number one?
For number one fuel.
All right, and I understand we're going to have a number of testifiers to come up and speak towards this as well, but are there any questions to the DE1 amendment, members? Any questions? No? Okay. We'll go ahead and vote on the DE1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevailed. All right, to your bill, Representative Keel.
Yes, I would like to ask Mr. Schoenfeld to join me.
All right. So, Mr. Schoenfeld, welcome to the committee. Please state your name, who you represent for the record, and proceed, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Jerry Schoenfeld. I work with both the Minnesota Soybean Growers and the Minnesota Biodiesel Council, which is the group that produces the biodiesel in Minnesota.
Welcome.
Mr. Chairman, I guess my comments are going to be, I think, fairly brief. First of all, I'd like to tell you a little bit about the importance of the state mandate in Minnesota as to what it's accomplished over the years. This was originated approximately 10 years ago in Minnesota, and at the time that it was passed, I guess from our perspective, we would not have dreamed it would have been as successful as it has been. And the reason I would state that is, first of all, we had several objectives in mind with regard to the biodiesel amendment or the mandate that was put in place. First of all, that we were certainly involved from the Minnesota Soybean Growers' standpoint of trying to find ways to improve the agricultural income to Minnesota farmers. Let me give you a little review of what that has meant. The typical price of soybean oil in at the time this bill was passed was about 11 cents a pound. In a bushel of soybeans, there are 60 pounds, and there are 49 pounds that become soybean meal, and there are 11 pounds that are soybean oil. We had a glut of several hundreds of millions of gallons of oil worldwide at the time this originally was looked at. And what has happened to the price of soybean oil is that it has gone from that 11 cents, which was, if you look at charts, was pretty much straight across the board in terms of the valuation of it. As biodiesel advanced throughout the United States, you can just see a graph that went up like a hill. And today, the price of soybean oil is about 52 cents. Simple cowboy math would indicate that that's, you know, about a 40-cent increase. At 11 pounds per bushel, that's $4.40. Now, we would not attribute all of the increase to the fact that there was biodiesel, but a significant portion. And I guess it's up to the economists to be able to argue about how much, but we believe that somewhere between $2.50 and $3.50 per bushel. We raised 320 million bushels of soybeans in Minnesota. So from an economic impact to the state, it has been a significant change. Secondly, as we watch the news even today, we see talk about shutting down the Straits of Hormuz, and we see a lot of other things in terms of gas prices going to $4, and of course diesel prices go right along with that, and all of these kind of things. And one of the things that we had hoped to do was to aid in the quest for energy independence. If you look at charts in terms of the amount of imported oil, we still import a lot of oil. But something that many of you may not know is that this past year is the first year since 1959 that there actually has been, we are net exporters in the United States of refined petroleum. And so that part of that is due to both the ethanol and biodiesel, biofuels effort that has been nationwide. I recently came from a meeting down in Florida in which it was at the Biodiesel National Conference, and people from the Petroleum Institute, the national folks there, talked about how much influence it had had. They certainly weren't always pleased with that because of the fact that it takes away from what they perceive as their market. But there, it was significant, and at some point under the RFS2, which is the national law that would mandate, for instance, this past year, 1 billion gallons of usage of biodiesel, and also does provide for a requirement for the usage of ethanol as well, that it would take up between 15 and 22% ultimately of the nation's fuel supply. Thirdly, we hoped to light a match. We were the first state in the country to do something like this, and we were to hope to light a match to other states in the country towards renewable fuels, in particular biodiesel. I'd like to show you just, I'm not going to pass this out, but I would show you that since Minnesota led the way on this, we have 10 other states that I could share with you in terms of different biodiesel mandates. There are 22 states that have now instituted grants and loans programs in order to promote the products. There are 11 states that have production incentives, and there are 31 states that have tax credits or exemptions. So in terms of lighting the match and movements towards this as a renewable fuel, that certainly has occurred statewide and also on a national level with the RFS2. Fourth, we wanted to create a seamless, fungible fuel system that is interchangeable within the fuel system. One thing about biodiesel is there is no retrofitting of engines relative to biodiesel usage. And there is a ability to use it in the existing fuel system. There are certain points of care that do have to be taken and certain protocols that have to be followed. And we've learned over the last 10 years how to improve that situation so that I know 4 or 5 years ago there was problems that we'll be reporting to many of you. Most of those problems, to my knowledge, have gone away. One of the reasons is that there was became a national standard in ASTM, which is the Association for Mr. Krogman might be able to help me, but it's Testing and Measures, American Society for Testing and Measures, or Manufacturing. And anyway, it is what sets standards for fuel in the United States. Biodiesel at a 5% or less blend meets the same D975 standard as regular diesel fuel. And there is also an additional standard for B100 called D6751 that has established these standards. Those have done much to unify as to what how the biodiesel is to be, what the specifications are, and have eliminated almost all of the problems that we saw with it. We've also improved the way that it's been put together in our blending capacity. And one of the other things that we tried to do, or hope to do, was to develop a system within Minnesota where the terminals, for instance, would be able to blend, and they'd be able to do it in such a way that it was uniformly done. And with very small exception, all the terminals are now have blending equipment with which to do that. So there's been a long way that we've come. In terms of a national effort, in terms of jobs and industry, according to estimates by the National Biodiesel Board, 39,000 jobs have been produced nationwide as a result of this industry, $3.8 billion to the GDP. There is also improved environment issues. There's about a 30% reduction in particulates when it comes to the environment from a B20. Now, we don't have that much in Minnesota, so it's not 30% in Minnesota, but it contributes almost on a linear case. At the present time, we're at B5. And in addition to that, all greenhouse gases, with the exception of NOx, are reduced significantly. NOx has been a question with some people because there's a slight increase, but at B5 or less, both Texas and California, two states, some of you might be familiar with the whole CARB thing in California and the discussions over the their environmental side of things. Those two states, Texas and California, are not states that traditionally are very friendly towards renewable fuels. And in both cases, they have now approved usage at these levels, and with no reduction in environmental benefit. So that is kind of a background as to what has happened in the past 10 years. In terms of the bill itself, we initially thought that we would try to bring forth a bill that would go towards meeting some of the needs of the three or four industries that still had particular problems. We recognized that there were differences there in the fact that the size of the engines in some cases were very different than over-the-road vehicles. Locomotives with railroads as an example, or some of the mining equipment. We have been working to try and resolve many of those issues. The OEMs or the manufacturers of engines now pretty much uniformly have adopted at least a B5 approval, and many of them go much above that. But there is still questions. And with that in mind, we initially brought forth a bill that went forward 3 years. As in all things, there is adjustments that happen within the legislature, and there have been a lot of negotiations and so forth. And so today that you have the bill before you. I don't know, Mr. Chairman, if there's a great deal more for me to say. Other than that, I think that we've had a policy from both Republicans and Democrats over the years in support of renewable fuels in many cases, and hope that could continue.
We do have a few questions. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Schoenfeld, a few years ago, and I don't recall the exact, I don't have it in front of me, I should have looked this up prior to committee today, but We did something for school buses. There was a concern with biodiesel in school buses in the winter months, I was carried that with a bipartisan support to make sure that our school buses using biodiesel weren't freezing up in the winter months, and our kids getting caught on the roadways in harsh weather. Does this have anything to do with any implications with that?
Mr. Chairman, and generally, that would be correct. There's one provision within this bill but it's not specific to school buses. The provision in the bill and the thing that happened that year that resolved some of that was the fact that oftentimes with regard to diesel fuel, there is a blending that takes place in the winter between number two and number one. What we found, and I'll admit to our surprise, was that when the federal government switched to ULSD, which is ultra-low sulfur diesel, that was a mandate that came in at the same time that the mandate for the biodiesel came in. Most of the testing we had done with biodiesel for a long period of time, 20 to 30 years, had been done with traditional diesel fuel. It wasn't with ULSD. What we found was that the ULSD acted chemically a bit different, and yet the best way I could describe it is kind of like Velcro. Velcro attaches to things, dust balls, whatever. Within the chemical composition of diesel fuel and biodiesel, there is a similar attachment that takes place with the fuel in some ways. I have to be careful here because Mr. Krogman, who knows way more about fuel than I, is standing there looking at me. I'd invite him to join me in the discussion if he wanted to. But one of the things we found was that with number one diesel fuel, which is a different kind of a diesel fuel than number two, it's a low aromatic compound, and it didn't have quite the same stickies that the number two had. I mean, that's the simplest way I can describe it. So we were finding some precipitation or fallout of the number one diesel fuel. So at that time, we requested of the governor to put in place a commissioner's order that would not have biodiesel placed into the number one diesel fuel, and that's what you and I talked about at the time. And that order was extended until March 31st of 2012, and in this bill it is extended until 2015. We recognize that there is still a problem with number one low aromatic fuel. The biodiesel task force has been working on this diligently for the last year or so. They are still working on it. A resolution has not yet totally been found as to what we need to do about that, and for that reason, in this bill, we supported the inclusion of the continuation of that exemption until 2015, and we are fairly very confident by that time that the resolution will be found.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so, Mr. Schoenfeld, our school kids are going to be safe until at least 2015. That's the bottom line.
I certainly believe so.
So, Representative Kuehl, thank you for bringing this forward. I really appreciate it on behalf of our school kids as well.
Mr. Schoenfeld, anything else on that?
No.
Okay. Representative Anderson, Paul.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I also appreciate this bill coming forward. And one of the reasons is this last fall we faced some shortages in diesel fuel, and I think this country runs on diesel fuel. And the demand for diesel is going up, and this is going to help us stretch our supplies of diesel fuel to that 5% level. I do have a question for Mr. Schoenfeld. A couple of years ago, the federal tax credit for bio expired or lapsed, and some companies had difficulty being profitable. That credit has since lapsed again. What do you see looking ahead in terms of companies manufacturing bio, and can they make it without that tax credit?
Schoenfeld.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't know how much detail you want to get into the complications of this, but I know that Representative Anderson and I have discussed the idea of what RINs are and how it involved in the pricing of biodiesel. There, under the federal RFS2, which is the Renewable Fuels Act, basically. There is a requirement of 1 billion gallons a year. At the present time, it is being discussed as to whether it will go to 1.3 billion next year in 2013. Under that act, there are two ways in which what is called obligated parties can fulfill their national obligation under that act. One of them is to actually blend the biodiesel itself. The other is to purchase basically a blending certificate from someone else that has blended it, and they can use that as proof that the gallon was blended and therefore meets their obligation. Because of that, there is competition for those certificates. And there is a RIN exchange as such that takes place where people actually purchase these certificates from people that don't need them. And they may not need them because they blend more than what their requirement is, or they may not need them because they're a non-obligated party that doesn't need to fulfill any requirements. I'll give you examples of that. It might be a jobber that decides to blend, quote, below the rack in order to get the advantage of the RIN. The RIN at the present time, I think on a wet gallon basis, is around $2.20 a gallon, I believe. Mr. Krogman, can you help me out? Is that correct? About $2.20 a gallon. So when you consider that and you subtract that from the value that you pay for the biodiesel itself, which the number I saw yesterday, and it varies depending upon location, was somewhere around $4 a gallon on biodiesel. If you subtract that RIN value, you're down to $1.80. Now, if in the days when the tax credit was there, that was a dollar tax credit, so it could drive it down even further. On the other hand, not everybody gets the advantage of that pricing system. So I want to make that clear. It's almost like there are two different pricing systems involved. If you are an obligated party, it becomes an expense to you. If you're a non-obligated party, it provides opportunity for profit. So there's a lot of things going on in competition, and that competition, we think, eventually will drive a more equilibrium within the market. So depending upon who you are, I could sit here and as a lobbyist on one side and say it raises the price of diesel, and I would be accurate. And on the other hand, I could say it lowers the price of diesel, and I would be accurate, depending upon who you are and how you participate in that system. So relative to the price situation, I can tell you that there are people that are blending below the rack that are making significant dollars off of it, or they wouldn't be doing it, and there are other people that think that it's too costly. So I don't have an exact answer for you, but from a biodiesel production standpoint, we feel that this system really has allowed the continuation, along with all the things I showed you amongst the states, including our own mandate, to make the biodiesel production part of it viable and sustainable for the future. I also might mention that we are running that tax credit is a federal tax credit. There has never been any money in Minnesota out of state treasury that's gone into something like this, different than ethanol. And in terms of the federal tax credit, as you know, it was not renewed when it was supposed to be over a year ago, but then it was renewed and it was made retroactive. There's still discussion about that going on. I can't read Congress any more than any other citizen of this country at this point in time, and I don't know if, in fact, it will be renewed or not. There are efforts to have that done.
Representative Anderson, follow-up?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Schoenfeld. We have no additional questions at this time. Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Looking at the DE one amendment here that was adopted, I see that it was switched from 2015 in the original bill to 2020. Why was that change made?
So, Representative Keel, would you like to take that?
It was kind of an agreement to give certain entities a little bit more time so that we could make sure that the biodiesel worked for them. In fact, this might be a good time for them to come up and speak about how it affects them.
That's a good idea. Representative Falk, I think the answer will be in some of the other testifiers. That's okay? Yeah? Okay,
she can hear us. Mr. Pagel?
Mr. Pagel, if you'd like to move forward, and then we'll have Ms. Backus, Mr. Estenson, and Mr. Lemke, and we have a few others after that as well. Please state your name, who you represent for the record, and begin.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Craig Pagel. I'm the president of the Iron Mining Association of Minnesota. Our trade association represents the iron mines up in northeastern Minnesota. Give you kind of a reference, while we're not as big as the agricultural community in Minnesota, and I'd like to say greater Minnesota, we do make up one-third of the gross regional product of that area, including northwestern Wisconsin. So we have a very big impact on the economy. I would like to speak in favor of the DE amendment. And maybe it would be easiest to answer the representative's question is that On the 8 years, one of the things that our mines pointed out, as you know, we're in expansion right now. They're buying a lot of new equipment. And one of those pieces of equipment are the haul trucks. They're about $3 million a piece when they're purchased. In purchasing those, because, and our furrows are a little deeper than yours, and we're having to go a little deeper than what we've been, as the iron formations tip to the south, we have to take over more overburdened, we're going longer distances. They usually buy these trucks to run about 60,000 hours with two major overhauls in between. Because of those stripping ratios, they're actually going to have to run 70,000 hours over their lifetime. And they basically run 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. It'd be like a conveyor belt or an auger that runs all the time, except they're actually very big trucks. And what we're finding in buying these vehicles is that while they might say you can use the B5, their warranties everywhere state, however, it doesn't include if you have problems with fuel. And another thing that we need to do is we need to, because of the beautiful area that we live in, we have a lot of Class 1 lands, which are the national parks, Boundary Waters Canoe Area, Isle Royale, and some tribal lands. So our NOx requirements from the EPA and the PCA are very stringent. And so the use of our of the trucks is built into those air emissions along with the other fuels. If you take that 70,000 hours, that equates 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, to about 8 years. And I think that's why we've agreed to the 8-year extension. As we buy these vehicles, it's not like a vehicle, like a car or truck that's made in the United States. These are vehicles that are made for very specialized mining, and we're probably the only ones in the United States using these. So it's not like a market can be changed that quickly. There are some changes being made and other requirements that kind of fall into the same time frames. So I hope that answers Representative Felt's question, and that's why we support this. We appreciate the representative and the chair working with all of us, and especially the agricultural community that's met with us.
Representative Falk, follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Pagel, thank you for the clarification. I guess the question I have is these trucks aren't used anyplace else, right? It's pretty much exclusively for your operations, or you said that you're the ones that are using them?
Totally in the mine, not licensed to be anywhere else, and we're the only ones using them, sir. Chair, I'm sorry.
Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Pagel, then, I'm assuming that there's a company that builds these, and they're the ones that are offering the warranty. So if you're the only customer, hopefully you'd be able to negotiate a little bit better warranty terms, because this 5% biodiesel issue, I mean, that should be a very small thing for them to factor in. And I don't think there's a whole lot of data that supports that, especially vehicles being built now, are going to have those complications.
Spiegel.
Chair, Representative. The problem is mining is very small in the United States compared to the world. This would end up being a very specialized piece of equipment. And to be quite honest, one of the problems isn't so much the fact that it's biofuel, but it's there's the fuel consistency for what we need to meet for the for these vehicles isn't always being met. And we're hoping that time frame will help do that. Again, we're a very small market. Give you an example, 75% of the iron ore coming out of northeastern Minnesota makes up 75%, I should say all the ore coming out of Minnesota makes up 75% of the steel made in the United States, which is about 70 million tons. China produces 700 million, and they're presently dumping steel in the United States as we compete with them.
Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Once again, just a question, where are these trucks built?
Mr. Pagel.
Chair, Representative. They're built all over the world. A lot of Caterpillar has moved to China. They're not, some are being made here. Basically, the two largest trucks that are being bought because of their capability, 240 tons, is Komatsu and Caterpillar.
Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I still think that, I mean, the world's moving towards having to look at renewable fuels, and the manufacturers are addressing these things. I do think that this exemption is somewhat exhaustive here at 8 years. I guess Also, I would say, just kind of to make a point, that if we're going to talk about the Chinese dumping all of the steel on the American market, maybe our American manufacturers or American mining companies shouldn't be necessarily supporting products that are made in or built in China. Maybe they should be looking at more at buying things that are built in the U.S.
Mr. Pagel, would you like to comment on that? Or
Just on the very first part, Chair and Representative, is I think what we're trying to make the point is, if you buy a vehicle at $3 million and it's built into your business plan, that if you have a shorter period of time that you either have to replace it or make a major overhaul. Major overhauls, when they have to redo the whole engine on one of these, is $400,000. And I guess what we're asking for is that the risk of that's being placed on us be recognized, and that it helps support the state in many ways through the mining, whether it's trust lands, taxes that we pay. You've got basically six mines this year that will pay $74 million in production taxes and about $34, $35 million to trust land royalties. So there aren't too many other businesses where six of them, actually three companies, are paying those kind of taxes. And we're hoping that you understand, as we like to support Greater Minnesota as well, we need your support in this case.
Representative Morrow, or excuse me, Representative Falk.
You have Falk. Mr. Chairman. I guess final point here is, I mean, that in agriculture, we build a lot of the stuff, tractors, equipment, that is coming from the iron ore that is being mined from the mining companies in the range. And a lot of that manufacturing is still done in the U.S. And so I'm just saying our agricultural community is doing a lot to go and support American manufacturing and to make an end use for the mining ore. So it just seems reciprocal that when we're trying to supply American-sourced energy, do rural economic development, it would be nice to have a little bit of reciprocal willing to work with us, because, I mean, agriculture, I think all of us would agree, has done a very good job of locating jobs and keeping them in Minnesota or in other parts of the United States, and that's important. We want to keep it that way, but we need to maintain that industry. We need to make sure that we have fair markets, and renewable fuels is one of the things that really has been good for agriculture. And so our partners, we would like them to embrace that, because we're using many of the products that your industry is so eloquently supplying.
Thank you, Representative Falk. And it was really refreshing. AGCO down in Jackson, they actually brought the plant from France, and they brought the high-powered tractors, and they're manufacturing them here. So that was refreshing. The governor flew down for that big event as well. So, yes, thank you for pointing that out. Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Keel. I understand that the bill in the DE-1 reflects a compromise that can move things forward, and I plan to support the amendment and the bill. Mr. Baker, I just want to be clear, following up on Representative Falk's questions, looking at this eight-year interregnum now, if you will, what will you all be doing to communicate with the manufacturers that in 2020 you got to be ready to go? What steps will you all be taking as a customer?
Mr. Pagel.
Chair, Representative, just the fact that this bill is up today, we've had a lot of attention, not only from the manufacturers, but to be real honest, one of our biggest problems is the refineries assuring that what might be certified as something is in fact that. Later I could talk to you about some problems that we have, but I just soon not do that here. I think the assurance is, well, two things. One, this is exemption. It doesn't say we can't use it. So if we get through that and we find that there's a good reason to use it, doesn't say we can't use it. It's an exemption from having to until some of the problems are solved. Then we'd be happy to use it.
Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a short follow-up. I just want to be clear, Mr. Baker. I think you're saying what I'd like to hear is that the mining industry in Minnesota is going to continue to work both using biodiesel and its machines, working with the refineries, working with the manufacturers, so that we don't come up to 2019 and say, oh gosh, we need another exemption, we didn't get anywhere.
Mr.
So I'm just looking for that reassurance.
Mr. Pagel.
Chair and Representative, you have that. Plus, to point out that all of our over-the-road vehicles are required to use it.
Yeah. Thank you. Representative Morrow, follow-up? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Pagel. We'll move to the next testifier, Ms. Backus, if you'd move, and Mr. Lemke.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Amber Backus from the firm of Leonard Street and Dinard here today on behalf of Canadian Pacific. It's a railroad company with about 1,200 miles of track in Minnesota and about a similar number of employees. We do appreciate the discussions that we've had on this issue, and we thank you for helping negotiate a compromise as well as Representative Keel to find a place that we can be in agreement with. Similar to Mr. Pagel's testimony, the railroad industry is highly capital intensive in nature. Railroad locomotives are extremely expensive equipment at about $2 million for a new piece of machinery that is expected to have a lifespan of 30 to 35 years with significant maintenance and upkeep that goes on with that equipment. Canadian Pacific is not adverse to using biodiesel. There has been testing done underway on the railroad in Canada. And as Mr. Schoenfeld said, our engine manufacturers are supportive of using up to B5 in engines. But I think with regard to a mandate, there are other issues that go into consideration in terms of your fuel purchases and what you look at in terms of what you're putting in this very expensive equipment that deals with the supply chain of fuel in the state of Minnesota as well as the cost. So when the railroad makes its decisions, it wants to make sure it's using something that's not only going to work in the engines, but is also cost-effective, and that is going to be delivered in a way that you know it's going to work well in that equipment. At the same time, in 2015, there are changes going on in the industry with regard to new locomotive engines that the federal government is requiring, Tier 4 engines. There's still some uncertainty about how those will work with biodiesel, especially when the state law is supposed to jump to B20 at that time. So we do appreciate having a little more time to plan for this, to work out the kinks with regard to some of the distribution system for purchasing our fuel in the state. And again, we thank everybody for this agreement.
Thank you, Ms. Backus. Please, Mr. Lemke, state your name and who you represent for the record. Begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Matthew Lemke. I'm with the law firm of Winthrop & Weinstein. I'm here on behalf of Burlington Northern Santa Fe. And I don't have too much more to add. I would just echo a thanks for Representative Keel, Representative Anderson, and you, Mr. Chair, for working with us to come to what we think is a reasonable compromise on the 2020 date, pushing out the exemptions. To Representative Morrow's question, I'd just like to let you know that we have been doing testing at higher blends, and we'll continue to do so, and I can tell you that today. Other than that, I don't have too much to add. I just appreciate the continued discussions on the topic.
Thank you. Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that. Mr. Chair, I don't know if we have other rail-related testifiers coming, but I would note, looking at the Twin Cities and Western website, the Twin Cities and Western website reads that the Minnesota Prairie Line is the first railroad in Minnesota to operate locomotives using 5% biodiesel fuel. So it is possible to operate a railroad on 5% biodiesel. Not to contradict what you're saying, you're saying you're testing. They apparently are testing by actually running their trains on biodiesel.
Very nice. Would you like to respond or? No. That's all right. Thank you, Representative Morrow. So, okay, any other questions for the testifiers? Seeing none, let's call up Mr. Brandt with the Minnesota Timber Producers, please. Mr. Brandt is here.
Wayne Brandt, Executive Vice President, Minnesota Timber Producers Association. Our members are loggers, log truckers, small sawmills, allied businesses throughout the state. We appreciate the bill and the amendment that Representative Keel has brought forward, the committee's consideration. Appreciate working with Mr. Schoenfeld and the Department of Agriculture and others over a number of years on this topic. We like to think that we're part of the agricultural community, work on other issues that occasionally come in front of this committee, and transportation issues and such, and like to think of trees as our tallest crop here in the state. You know, we appreciate the exemption when it was originally provided. Our, you know, concern may be taken care of by global climate change, global warming. If that continues, you know, we burn biodiesel in our trucks. Some of the logging equipment runs on biodiesel during the warmer months of the year. Lord knows this year we probably could have burned, this winter probably could have burned it right out of the fryers at McDonald's, given that we've had a lot of problems with not enough cold weather freezing down the swamps, but that's an entirely separate matter. You know, our concern is, you know, we deal out in the woods with small volumes to fuel the logging equipment. and it sits out overnight. Most winters we've got 30 and 40 below. We periodically have difficulties with straight P40 diesel, sometimes sourced out of Canada, sometimes here locally. In those weather conditions, we hope that over time, working with the department, with the Soybean Association and others, that all of those chemical issues related to temperature, will get resolved. But we appreciate the committee's efforts and the bill. And thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brandt. Any questions for the testifier? No. Seeing none. Thank you for your testimony. Ms. Gothier, were you wanting to testify at this time, or did anybody have any questions? That? No. Okay. Thank you. Any questions for the department? No. Any other questions? Anybody else would like to testify for or against this bill in the audience? Any other testifiers? No. Seeing none. Representative Keel? Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I've got a couple things I'd like to ask about this bill. I'd maybe entertain a couple oral amendments here. I was just reading on 1.9. We have the words "and copper mining." Do we have any copper mines in the state?
Mr. Pagel? Would you like to answer that question?
Again, for the record, Craig Pagel with the Iron Mining Association, Chair Representative Falk. Not at this time, but they are developing.
Thank you. Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, I guess we're giving exemptions to industries that don't even exist currently in the state. That seems, kind of interesting to me. I don't know. I think when we're talking about industries, and if you're looking at purchasing trucks, we don't know when this operation of copper mine could go online, but I hope would be that you'd consider using biodiesel as a part of the content when those vehicles are in operation. It's good for our soybean industry. It's good for our renewable fuels industry. And so I'm curious as to why we're even giving an exemption to an industry that doesn't exist. And so I think that we should be talking about existing industries that have existing problems. So I would move to strike the words "and copper" in line 1.9.
So Representative Falk has an oral amendment to strike on lines 1.12. And copper mining.
I'm working out the DE1 amendment, Mr. Chairman, which I believe is what we're on.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So on lines 1.9, strike "and copper mining." That's correct, right?
That's correct.
Yeah. And to that point, we had a nice visit here last week. We were up in Representative McElfatrick's district and visiting with some explorers up there, if you will, checking for new metals and everything else, which is very exciting. And, there's a number of challenges that they have as well, whether it's permitting process and the length of time that it takes. And it'd be nice to be able to open up some of those mines and to be mining those metals out of there, too. And it's a wide array of metals, right, Representative yeah. McElfatrick, I see here. A wide array of metals. And Representative Falk, I'm going to speak against your oral amendment at this time. I don't know if anybody else, Representative McElfatrick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, in my district we have exploration going on specifically for copper and nickel, and I believe that those are minerals also that we're working on with the permitting process with Polymet, not inside my district, but very important minerals, not just to the area, but to the United States, and some of them strategic for our defense, I believe. Now, I'm not quite so positive about that, but these are things that are very important. With Polymet, hopefully that is imminent mining. With Kennecott, in my district, they are still in the exploration stage, but should they identify sufficient quantities of ore there in situation within the rock that would allow them to effectively and profitably mine, then that's something that would be extremely important. And I would speak against this amendment as well, simply because it's one more barrier for something that is important to the state.
Thank you, Representative McElpatrick.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Falk.
I think when you restated or restated my oral amendment, I want to make sure that it's clear that I was only moving to strike the words "and copper," not "and copper mining." I think you said it was "and copper mining," so I want to make sure that we are clear the amendment would be to strike "and copper." To Representative McElpatrick's point, this is the Ag Committee, and biodiesel is very important to the agricultural community, and I do think that if we're going to have a new industry established, being that they're looking at all new equipment and they're looking at putting in place new procedures, that it would be very fair to go and expect that they play by the rules as anybody else is having to play by if you're establishing a new industry. Now, we're giving exemptions to some current industries, some current operating industries that are here, that are in process. This would be a new startup, as you alluded to. And so I feel, as fairness to our soybean growers, to our biodiesel industry, that we should have that market available to them, that they should have to play by the same rules. And they're going to have to be looking at new equipment. They should, as I alluded to before, maybe work with their manufacturer, being that they're the only people buying this equipment, to get those warranties extended towards covering biofuel, because I really don't think that there is any evidence we've seen in other industries. Agricultural is moving very heavily towards biofuels acceptance. Most of the new tractors you buy, the engines are at least B5 capable, if not B20 capable. And so it's not impossible for this to be done. But I have a hard time giving continued exemptions to additional industries when this has been one of the great success stories for agriculture. And I don't think that we should be turning that back right now. And we have to remember, too, that for every gallon of biofuel that we're not using here, that's not produced here, we're having to offset that with a gallon of diesel fuel that's coming from someplace around the world, and oftentimes places that are not very friendly towards us. So I would much rather see us investing in our own resources here. So I speak very much in favor of my amendment. I think it's very good. It shows clearly that we want to support agriculture and that we're willing to go and actually make a stand for it.
Representative Falk renews his motion to strike "and copper" on lines 1.9. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No.
No.
Motion does not prevail. Representative Falk, you said you may have another one.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would also move to strike on the DE the line 1.8 and renumber accordingly, because I do feel that we had testimony from the railroads, but once again, looking at what is the number one commodity that is hauled by railroads or agricultural commodities, and I do think that it's only fair that we continue to push them to have to play by the same rules as every other industry.
Representative Falk moves to strike line 1.8. Any discussion? Seeing none, I speak against this. Representative Keel?
Yes, I speak against it also.
All right. Seeing no discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion does not prevail. Representative Falk, do you have others?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Not at this time.
All right. Any discussion to the bill? Members, any discussion to the bill? Seeing none, Representative Keel renews her motion to pass House File 2158 as amended and be referred to the General Register.
Yes.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Members,
thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Keel, and thank you to all the testifiers. Pardon me? What's that? We all right? Okay. Members, anything else on the agenda? Seeing none. We are adjourned. Thank you.